thanks, Mark. Glad to be here. This is really a different kind of group that I'm used to attending. My name is Safa Rashchi. I am a venture capitalist in Silicon Valley. We run an early stage venture firm called Think Plus Ventures. We invest in seed and series A across a number of industries, with our focus being that we like to find really deep market pain points. So we focus not on the entrepreneurs, but first on the market that we research. My background is research analyst on Wall Street for 10 years. My friends joked that I gave Eric Schmidt the idea of how to make money at Google. It's only partially true because I did meet with Eric after 2 weeks that he had joined Google, and he asked me what should we do, and I said you should look at this company called GoTo.com. They had invented the search monetization model. So of course he knew what to do, but the rest of it is history. And after that, I started looking at private companies. I made, after I left Wall Street, I made 30 investments. That's 7 of them sold to public companies. And in 2017, we started the first fund, which has now been 4x'd. We have had 3 unicorns and an exit, and now we're raising our fund 2. I have to say, this is exciting. Mark, thanks for inviting me. I mean, I've never really seen such eclectic topics and people coming together, and there is really a common thread among these that we don't see in Silicon Valley. So I'll make it short. So what does excite me? What excites me is the potential for the technologies, and not just Web 3.0, but other technologies that are being developed, especially in healthcare, but also different business model innovations in fintech, in edtech, that can actually empower more people, bring all of these things, have more people access to these services across the world. I'm especially focused on education. I'm really hoping that over my lifetime, at least, we can improve quality education and access to it to many people. So these things excite me because I see some movements towards it, but there's a whole lot that that I'm fearful of, but I don't want to take too much time on the negative at this point. So that's me.
Hi, nice to meet you. I'm Julia Monfrini-Pief, the founder and managing partner of Pace Healthcare Capital. We are an early stage investment firm investing in healthcare tech and digital health based here in Chicago. Last year, we invested in 3 companies. It was really our first year of capital deployment. And there are so many interesting things to do in Chicago in healthcare tech, and I'll try to speak to that. We invest in late seed, series A and B. We really look for critical solutions in the healthcare field, so many issues that we need to pay attention to. 2, a diverse leadership team, and 3, commercial traction, so signals that the company is on the rise and about to get to scale. My background, before starting Pace, I spent a little over 10 years in private equity. My last role in private equity was with a Canadian pension plan called CDPQ, where I was in charge of our direct healthcare investments for North America and LATAM. So deployed about $1 billion of capital in private equity. And anytime my investments were trying to deploy software to reach out to patients or automate parts of their business, they were always partnering with a small company that somehow Silicon Valley didn't like as much. But you know, because they weren't necessarily growing as fast as we wanted or whichever. And so that prompted to start Pace here in Chicago, which is really the center of health, the healthcare industry in the US. What excites me? Well, COVID was a tragedy in many different ways, but it brought the healthcare industry forward by about a decade in just a year and a half. So we're now seeing companies, hospitals, modernizing the healthcare delivery models, the way they interact with patients, and really driving outcomes in ways that would have taken so much longer if COVID hadn't happened. And this is creating many opportunities. Now that the sanitary emergency is decreasing, we actually see hospitals coming back into deploying more technologies, and so we're almost engaging now in a new frontier. I was yesterday at the American Telemedicine Association We looked at innovators, and we've seen technologies such as handheld portable ultrasounds so that mothers-to-be can actually check on their fetuses at home with an accuracy rate to find a heartbeat of 95%. And now we can start thinking about, you know, areas that are hard to reach for hospitals, areas in crisis. So actually this company is deploying in Ukraine so that their doctors can help mothers-to-be in Ukraine care for their soon-to-be-born babies. And that would not have been possible a decade ago. Another company, actually, I keep asking Lauren, what is it we can do for health equity on the south side? And he keeps telling me, don't come to me with your gadgets. I don't have broadband access. And so we now see a company that developed a tiny device that can broadcast data from patients through cellular networks in very, very low connectivity areas. And so healthcare is moving forward. What actually scares me is not what happens in healthcare tech, is what happens in the periphery. What happens if the stock markets close? What happens if other parts of the economy don't do as well? Because our companies continue to need funding in order to get to scale, and this may actually impact the rate at which we do that. So I keep an eye on what goes on, but I would say in our field, fundamentals continue to stay really robust.
Thanks, Julia. And great job, of course. My name is Eddie Vanderpart. I indeed come from a small town, Leiden, important town.
Does anyone know the importance of Leiden?
Eddie comes from.
10 points for Simon and free beer.
It's where our pilgrims went. They were wanting freedom, then they saw too much freedom in Leiden, and they came to America.
That's right. And that's exactly why I came too. Too much freedom is not good. I came to the US 20 years ago, so it's a while. So I consider myself half American, half Dutch. I started a fund under the tutelage, if you like, of Mark with 361, together with another 361 stalwart and ex-family office manager, Rich Sobel. And we do early stage, late seed through Series B impact investments in sectors, what we call the most important impact sectors, so climate tech, agri-tech, health tech. We did the health tech part with none other than Julia, which you're extremely excited about, and education. And so those are the four sort of pillars of our domain. We define impact is always a very difficult word. It's easy to say, but very difficult to sort of define. But we define it very simply as a positive outcome on the world. So reduction of CO2 in climate tech, equal access to education in education, more productive use of resources or more yielding resources in agri-tech, for example. And at the same time, we want obviously our companies to provide a market return at a minimum. So a lot of people always ask, how can you combine those two? Is it not a little bit of philanthropy? And we say no. We can combine those two and hold exactly the same, exactly those two accountable, because more people want this. Tomorrow, I think John Dennison is going to have a keynote speech, and he uses the word triple upshift for that. So stakeholders, suppliers, customers right now want to be more thoughtful about the types of products and types of services they use more than ever before. And obviously it's not a black and white thing, so there is such thing as a green premium, quoted by sort of Bill Gates saying, you know, the difference between a product that emits, let's say, CO2 versus not, and the difference in price, it's called the green premium. And we obviously sometimes invest in that premium, but always with the idea that eventually the unit economics will outweigh that green premium in the long term, because again, it has to be a sustainably profitable company in the long run. What excites me is that, and I think it was Roy Amara, a Stanford computer scientist, who said, we overestimate the impact of technology in the short run and underestimate the impact of technology in the long run. What excites me is the impact of technology in the long run. And one of the examples is, there's many examples in healthcare, but one of the examples in agritech, which is one of my favorite verticals, is vertical farming. Vertical farming is an unbelievable growth segment.
Came from a Chicago guy, right? Ron Diamond?
Mm. That's right. By Ron Diamond, we invested too. It's been billions of dollars plowed into it. It's also very dangerous and overheated, right? The moment Silicon Valley starts plowing billions, you have to sort of, head for the exit typically. But the idea is that if the unit economics work out, vertical farming can really provide a future for folks and for countries and for cities without opportunity to have access to fresh fruits and vegetables because of the indoor vertical farming that's not related to sort of climate change or droughts or anything like that. And obviously, it's very difficult to sort of make the analysis. Can we provide unit economics, because it's a crop and it's a commodity? And so we think the answer is yes, you can. You have to be very careful what you invest in. And we invested in technology that eliminated most labor, which is one of the hardest components to get rid of. But seeing that and seeing that problem to sort of essentially feed 1.1 billion people that are sort of underfed and malnourished, and that part of that solution to it will be vertical farming. Seeing money pour into it and folks dramatically making steps to, let's say, decrease the price of indoor farmed lettuce, which came from 7 to 5 to 3, and hopefully by mid next year or so, it will sort of break the $2 barrier. Is kind of remarkable, and that excites me very much. And this is an example of what we follow and what we do.
Thank you, Andy. My name is Michael Spitt. I'm coming from Germany, running a small equity boutique called Equitas. Equitas is doing deal-by-deal transactions, and we are taking over also responsibility in companies. So I'm acting also as a CEO of a fintech company, which is called Cleverbridge, based on the other side of the river. It's in Cologne and in Chicago. Let me start with what excites me. When I left in 2020, the last conference of S361, this was the last one where we have an in-person meeting, and I'm really excited that we are starting again these type of conferences and bringing people together in a different environment, not on Zoom. Zoom is great. Everything which we do on virtual things is good, but to have the interconnection and personal relation, that's also is better, and this gives also some different moments which creates some activities between people which are neglected in the past. We see this, and we will talk about future of work and everything else. This has also an impact, and I believe that socializing is a very helpful and useful tool for making business. Coming back to fintech, Equitas is investing in different types of investments. So we had machinery investments, we had a lot of telecom and IT investments, and I was excited when I was appointed and asked in 2019 to take over parts of Cleverbridge, and got the opportunity to bring the company from a stage of founder-led to PE-led. Yes, I managed this interim period, and we sold the company last year, and I will come back to that point a little bit later. This was an exciting time as I learned a lot of the industry. The industry for itself is booming. So investing in fintech is not wrong. Fintech, if you do it right, and if you go to the right part of the fintech industry, this is something, and it is that where we have a long-term impact of technology. It's not a short-term investment. I'm not talking about those things which are done currently by banks and which are used from other perspectives, using Wustilogy. I'm talking about those things where fintech help company to get better processes. The company Clever, which I'm running at the moment, is exactly on that point. It's the advanced part of fintech where we combine different processes, payment processes, checkout processes on the internet, technology processes on anti-money money laundering, and also the complete kind of developing the marketing strategy for companies. And there are a lot of companies we got onboarded in the last 2 years during COVID, which has changed their processes and which use now, which are using now the services we are offering because they are, see that working on the internet and doing these complete processes from an outside perspective. It's much more healthy for them and gives them a different challenge. Yeah, so we have grown the company from 500 million to a billion in 2 years' time. Still by having the processes in place. But this is also a challenge for everybody because we are in the in war of talents. The most exciting thing we had for was that we closed the relation with the Ukrainian company and we got 50 developers onboarded in 2019. This is currently also a challenge for us to support them during the war. Yeah, but this was great that we did this at that time because at the moment, there is nothing in the market where we can, what we can do to fulfill the gaps we have on the technology development. To give you a little bit more of the insight of the industry, what we have seen, my company Cleverbridge is 15 years old, and when I took it over, and we have seen that there are a lot of competitors in the market, but there is a huge amount of money which has been spent also by investors to bring further competitors to the market. So there's a huge company in the UK called Paddle. They raised 500 million last year still for an idea, and they hired 1,000 developers in India just to bring in the payment services onto the market. This is a clear signal that a lot of people believe in these type of technologies and everything that's going on. But on the other side, the flip side of the medal is less developers, last resources. We have spoken about in different other meetings during lunch that this is definitely a lack, but there is also a lack in developing the right technologies. AI, everybody should be working on intelligences and establishing that one. So for us, on anti-money laundering and checking this one completely automatic is a must. And having this established, it took us only 6 months, but to work on the AI and develop this step by step, this is an important topic for everybody, because then we can also only make sure that we fulfill the requirements, and the requirements are given by the governments. So the fintech industry is a completely regulated industry, and especially in Europe, we have seen a lot of changes on the law. On the laws which are restricted for everybody and which are hindering us to do something more advanced. And this is also, from the perspective of an investor, a risk. So just to give you a heads up on that one, and this scares me, we closed the transaction with a PE company last year in April. The change of control process to transfer the license is not finalized yet, so we have not the closing. Yeah, so this is something which is also hindering the industry a little bit of getting further money in that, because transactions are restricted also by the different regulators. The SEC took 8 months to transfer our license to the new shell to the new setup. In Europe, it's still ongoing. So,
is there a price adjustment?
There is no price adjustment. We have a good deal. Yeah, so the lawyers did good work on that. Yeah, so we don't have a MAC clause in the contract. Yeah, so.
Let's let Gerald.
Okay.
Take it home.
I'll be brief. Gerald Beecham, glad to be with everyone again this afternoon. I was with you all back in September in a different context around cannabis, but I'm here I think on this panel, primarily to talk about technology-related things. I was a venture partner and in a fund called Workbox Ventures that is primarily focused on future of work, fintech, and proptech. And what excites me is similar to what a lot of folks have already kind of raised. Going back 25 years, I was on a predecessor to Apple Pay. I'm on the patent to a predecessor to Apple Pay going back 25 years. And so when you talk about it takes a while, it takes a while. But that gives me tremendous hope and optimism because I just refied my house and with a top 20 mortgage provider bank, and I still had to cut a check. I could only pay my mortgage by check. Life insurance, same thing. So unless you, so it's crazy how antiquated a lot of the industries that we participate in, we call finance and big tech. Prop tech, I am an advisor to a company that right now is helping streamline the asset management process for a number of big services because they still use Excel and spreadsheets and do a lot of data entry. So a lot of basic things that I think we take for granted and we assume are advanced, but in reality, there's still a lot of basic processes in the back offices of a lot of big organizations are antiquated to say the least. The last point I'll make is, and Andy and I were talking about this at lunch, but there's a company that happens to be focused on, a fintech company focused on the cannabis space and underwriting, providing kind of microloans to cannabis operators. But the beauty of that, of their capability is, they can underwrite loans and make loans at $500 a pop, which when you think about access to capital and rethinking the underwriting model that a lot of banks have, I was at J.P. Morgan for a bunch of years, so in the cannabis space, if you've done any work there, it's amazing to me how the legal entity structures look like J.P. Morgan, and these are million-dollar companies. So I think that that's something that makes me optimistic. I think pessimism, I'm kind of a pessimist by nature. If anyone that knows me may know that. I'd say I'm 48, and so I've never lived in a rising rate environment. I've never run a business in a rising rate environment. I think most of us in this room probably have never run a business in a rising rate environment. So what that looks like over the next 20 years is a big question mark to me. The next 3 to 5 in particular are gonna cause a lot of shocks, I think, in a lot of credit portfolios and other places, especially in real estate. Next 20 years, tons of opportunity. And I'm waiting for, being a pessimist at heart, I'm really a distressed guy, so I'm waiting for the real cracks in the foundation to really get after. But in the interim, we'll have some fun in fintech and proptech and other places. So thank you.
So just questions, comments from what you heard about these industries? Trademark this.
Yeah. I'm David Lane with 21 CIG Capital down in Miami. Mostly real estate based, but this is regarding your vertical farms and your agri-tech. Is that the only thing you guys are looking at, vertical farms regarding the agri-tech, or is there other innovative processes that you're looking at for agri-tech?
There's lots of technology we look at. A lot around analytics. We very much have a sort of CapEx light model. So analytics software that increases productivity or that better understands yield. For example, analytics that improves the understanding of the various the dynamics and the parameters in farms we look at. We're currently evaluating couple of companies from Israel in that respect. Funnily enough, my home country in Israel, they're two, I think, most sort of sought after countries for agriculture technology outside of the States. And so we're constantly scouring the market for new sort of software, AI, robotics based technologies that can either improve productivity or resilience against pests, which is also decreasing a lot of productivity in the farm. But also, for example, we look more upstream on the food side.
Does that include cattle and stock?
Yeah, they're interestingly enough, we came across an interesting company that by incorporating little chips in the color of a cow, understands 5 days before the farmer whether the cow is sick or not, based on the pattern of walking and resting, and therefore can, you know, improve the health of a cow faster and increase the productivity and the milk.
Could you talk a little bit more about what specifically in the fintech, edtech space that you're focused in, perhaps any intersections there?
Sure, happy to. Within edtech, we have several companies. The biggest one that's been the most successful is called ApplyBoard. It's in Canada. And they connect international students to colleges and universities in U.S. and in Canada, U.S. and Europe. The model is very good because it actually helps these students get into the right college without having to go through the arduous process of having someone fax their documents to school, wait to see if they accept it, and see without knowing which school to apply. So this is essentially a tech platform that makes everything automated using some AI, but mostly really just basic technology, takes the documents, sends it to university, and university also sends the application electronically. So no paper checks in here. And it's highly lucrative. We invested in the company at 12 million valuation, it's now worth 3.4 billion. Their mission is democratizing education overall. And within that context, we're looking at other companies that can help students get to higher education more easily. One of those companies is called Empowerly, which essentially is democratizing the college counseling business, which is a very expensive and very difficult business, by making it accessible to middle classes and others through mentorships. So it, again, it's a marketplace that connects students with mentors through a tech platform that helps the mentors actually guide the students properly and charges a fee. Within fintech, I'm really most excited about inclusion models. One of our companies is called Perch. They just renamed themselves to Altro. They actually is one of our, unfortunately, the only minority-based founder from a disadvantaged family who came up with the idea that especially students, but also people who have lower income, who don't have any credit, have to have a way to start building that credit. And this can be done by all these irregular payments, such as subscriptions to Netflix and even rent and other payments that they pay. So they created this model and they worked with all the major credit agencies to accept these, to start building credit for these young people and eventually bring them into the fold. So overall, I think that we really have to bring a lot, many more people into this fold of digital platforms, whether it's digital health, digital education, or fintech. And within that, I really believe that having both access to internet and broadband access is the most fundamental right that everyone should have. And that is the biggest thing that I think we're still missing in a major way. So I'll stop there, see if you have any questions.
If I may, a quick follow-up on that one would be, you expressed earlier, I think, that you said that your kind of key investment range was seed or pre-series A, which is pretty low for people in this room. How do you source, how do you find those deals that are so small? There must be so many.
There are. We screen about 1,500 deals a year. By screening, I mean that we get the pitch book, we take a look and decide, do we want to spend some time on this or not? And we spend about, we look through about 200 of them more diligently, have a meeting or a call or a Zoom call with them. Out of those, we do due diligence with about 50 of them, which means we do several calls, we talk to their customers or their investors or others, and we do industry research, and we invest in about 5 or 6 in a year. So where we get deals are from a number of sources. We are highly tied to Stanford and Berkeley and the group of entrepreneurs, about several hundred of them, who give us the deals. We do inbound, outbound deal sourcing, especially to research papers that we write and publish, so people find us. And finally, through a network of venture capitals like us, because that's one of the beauties of our business, that it's really not a competition, but at best a cooperation, but oftentimes a cooperation. So we syndicate deals with others. I've been getting deals from investors in Miami, in New York, and other places. We have a company in London. We have three companies in Canada. So a lot of things. Once you're in the system, deal sourcing isn't really that difficult anymore.
So just because you're wearing these shoes, I have to like call on you to come. One of his owners is the owner of the Cincinnati Reds, so maybe it's part of that. We're talking about industries and what excites us, and just, you know, what you're doing. And don't talk about scared, just what excites you the most right now? Introduce yourself.
Sure. So my name is Mohsin Masood. I'm the founder and CEO for Recruit. Sorry I was late. Delayed flights, mass transit, lots of issues. What's exciting about the industry right now is the opportunity in different industries. We're specifically within Web 3.0, blockchain, decentralized measures. That's the product that we have. We do real estate tokenization, essentially. But the possibilities of growth within this industry are massive, if done correctly. And that's where the biggest issue usually is. How do you make sure you're doing it in a compliant manner? How do you make sure your offerings are not in breach of securities law, or is not going to get you into trouble with SEC or some of the other three and four that are regulators? And so that's the opportunity, which is the single most exciting thing for sure.
Perfect. Cool. Well, we have one last panel standing is between us and breakouts. I think even there are drinks outside. Mass in. So let's say thank you to this panel.
Come join our 361 firm community of investors and thought leaders. We have a lot of events created by the community as we collaborate on investments and philanthropic interests. Join us.